Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's virtual event. This afternoon, August 17th, we discuss vaccine mandates and exemptions, public universities, private colleges, and more. My name is Evelyn Hildebrand, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Group for the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Professor Ronald J. Colombo and Ms. Stephanie Taub, who will moderate the discussion this afternoon. Stephanie is Senior Counsel with First Liberty Institute, where she focuses on litigation, appellate advocacy, and legal education. She has written numerous articles which have been published of different places, including the Texas Review of Law and Politics, National Review, the Daily Signal, the Washington Times, the Des Moines Register, and the New York Daily News. She's also a 2017 James Wilson Fellowship recipient. Stephanie will introduce our speaker, Professor Ronald Colombo. After our speaker gives opening remarks, we will turn to the audience for questions. We will be accepting audience questions throughout the event this afternoon. If you do have a question, please enter it into the Q&A tab at the bottom of your screen, and our speaker will answer it as time permits. With that, thank you for being with us today. Stephanie, the floor is yours.
Wonderful. Thank you, Evelyn, for the introduction, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this discussion on a very timely and important issue. So today we will be discussing vaccine mandates, particularly in the context of public and private universities. So we'll talk a little bit about their legality, the religious and other exemptions, and some of the legal challenges that have come up already. So we're very fortunate to have with us today, Professor Ronald Colombo. He is a law professor at Hofstra University since 2006. He teaches courses in corporations, securities, and contract law. His research and scholarship focuses primarily on the application of non-economic principles and norms to these fields. So as relevant here, his scholarship includes the interaction of First Amendment law on these fields. So he's the author of The First Amendment and the Business Corporation, published in 2015. And some of his scholarship has touched on religious liberty issues like the article that we'll be discussing today. So to frame the discussion of vaccine mandates, we have a fantastic journal article from Professor Colombo. It's titled, When Exemptions Discriminate, Unlawfully Narrow Religious Exemptions to Vaccination Mandates by Private Colleges and Universities. So Professor Colombo, thank you for being here today. Can you tell us a little bit more about your article and the importance of the arguments it raises in light of the fact that over 600 colleges and universities have already issued some form of vaccine mandate for students or faculty?
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Stephanie, and the work that you are doing and the work that the First Liberty Institute is doing is tremendous and tremendously important in this area. So hats off to you and your team for being at the forefront of this. In the trenches, you know, I'm just sitting behind writing articles. You're actually doing the fighting. So God bless you for that. And thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this. And of course, to our participants for showing up. So my article addresses the fact that in writing the article, I came to discover that students at private colleges and universities are among the least protected classes of individuals in our society. If you go to a public university or public college, you have constitutional protections. If you go to a private institution, however, those do not apply. And moreover, the federal civil rights legislation that does cover colleges and universities does not address religious discrimination. So unless you are in a state, and I focused on New York, and let me just start by saying what I say is going to be focused on New York. New York's the only state I researched. However, it would be applicable to any state that has on its books legislation similar to New York's. So what New York has on its books is legislation that states, New York human rights law, that colleges and universities, private colleges and universities, cannot discriminate against their own students on the basis of a variety of characteristics, including religion. if that religious tag weren't there, those students would have zero protection under federal law, as far as I was able to discern, and none under the Constitution. So, you know, depending on the state you are at, if you are a religious student at a private school, private college or university, you really are vulnerable to a type of discrimination that is inconceivable for many of us to conceive of. What I had to do, so that's what my article focuses on. So now getting to the vaccine situation, as we know, a lot of colleges and universities have rolled out vaccination mandates. What I've discovered and what my article addresses is that, first of all, I'm not positing that private colleges and universities have the authority to lawfully mandate vaccinations among their students. It looks as though they do. The courts so far have said that they have, and that's not the focus of my article. Secondly, at least in New York, if they do roll out a mandate, they don't seem to need to promulgate an exemption for any reasons. They just don't seem to, the law does not seem to, again, this is beyond the scope of my article. So I'm granting, but let's just take for granted, they can promulgate these vaccination mandates and they don't need an exemption. Okay, so where are we? Well, my article addresses the situation where they do provide for an exemption for religious purposes. And what I've discovered is once they take that step, those exemptions must be non-discriminatory. Like you cannot, so if you're going to roll out a religious exemption, you cannot discriminate on the basis of religion with regard to the promulgation and implementation of that exemption. And what I found is that colleges are apparently blowing right through this requirement not to discriminate on the basis of religion when it comes to these exemptions. I've identified at least four ways in which they do this. Sometimes it's facially, just on the policy space itself, but oftentimes it's in the implementation. Like the policy might be facially neutral, but it's being implemented in a way that is discriminatory. And I'll get to that in a moment. Let's see, what else should I, I'm trying to think what else I could add to round out the context here. Well, here's one interesting thing. So in the article, for those of you who've read it, I've had to rely upon a lot of federal law and constitutional law because there's an utter lack of cases under New York human rights law addressing this very situation. The cases do not seem to come up. I guess that's because most colleges do not openly discriminate against students on the basis of religion. Certainly the whole COVID vaccination mandate is sui generis. I mean, the vast majority of colleges require vaccines that the state also requires. This is a very unique situation where private colleges are adding to that list and then putting out exemptions that are very stringent and very strictly being administered. So I think we do have a perfect storm that's giving rise to these situations that has not, you know, you haven't seen before. So what I've had to do is rely on a lot of authority, analogous authority, in other areas, as any good lawyer or scholar would do, and then apply it to the situation of religious exemptions to vaccination mandates. And let me just, you know, get us past an initial hurdle. How can I get away with doing that? Because I do rely a lot on First Amendment jurisprudence. Now, as we all know, the First Amendment, the jurisprudence there, a lot of it revolves around the power of the state and separation of church and state issues. I'm not a fan of that term, but I'm using it because you all know what I mean by that. So how is that? What does that have to do with discrimination? If you dig deeply into a lot of these cases, these First Amendment cases, you see that a core animating principle behind the religion court clauses and how they're adjudicated is discrimination. So the free exercise clause, you know, you can't say you could build, Christians can build a church here, but Muslims cannot. That's a free exercise violation. But why? Because you're discriminating. You're picking one religion over the other. Smith, right, the Employment Division case versus Smith that we all know about, taught that a facially neutral promulgation that hurts religion, that is okay. You can get away with that. But once you start picking and choosing and playing favorites, that is unconstitutional. Well, that's discrimination, right? So I flesh this out in the article. At the root of a lot of these First Amendment cases, even the Establishment Clause cases, is the sense that it's unconstitutional for the government to play favorites among religions. The government must be neutral. And what's the opposite of neutrality? Discriminating. You're taking sides. So now just to sort of then jump to the chase, how is it that schools, and I look forward to questions from you in the audience, but how is it that schools are indeed discriminating on the basis of religion with regard to these exemptions? I've identified at least four ways in the paper. These overlap. Let me just flesh them out. And with that, I think we're well armed to discuss the issue and ask informed questions. One would be you don't see this very often, but overt discrimination, right? You could imagine a situation where a school would say, the exemption is only available for Jehovah's Witnesses or something like that. You couldn't do that. And no school has been ham-handed enough to actually write that out. However, a lot of schools and this sounds conspiratorial, but you can go on websites and see this, like legitimate websites. They keep lists that say these religions don't permit their adherents to take vaccines, and these religions do permit adherents to take vaccines. And if you then, as a student, apply for a vaccination exemption, the school religiously profiles you and states, oh, well, you know, Stephanie is a Christian Scientist, so Stephanie can get the exemption. But oh, no, Stephanie is a Roman Catholic. She can't get the exemption, regardless of the beliefs that Stephanie put forth in her own application. Schools are, I would say, religiously profiling students and saying these denominations get the exemptions and these denominations don't get the exemptions. That is a form of religious discrimination. You're not allowed to do that. Number two, I say there's the discrimination against heretics, for lack of a better term, or for those who hold heterodox beliefs. And this is related to part one. As we know, certain bishops have made certain statements in the Catholic Church about the vaccination. But as we also know, not every Catholic believes absolutely everything that they're taught and they grow up with, and that's in the catechism that the Pope teaches, et cetera, et cetera. So what if you belong to a religion that teaches A, but you believe B? Do you lose your rights? No, you can't. If your belief in B is sincere and genuine, and the school decides it's not going to grant it to you, it would if you belong to a different religion. But because of your professed faith, you're going to be religiously profiled. I call it discriminating against heretics. They're basically saying they're taking the role of the inquisitor, and they're saying as a Catholic, you must believe this. And if you believe something else, either it's not true or we're not going to credit it. That's a form of religious discrimination because it's the individual student who's applying for the exemption, not any particular bishop. Third, there seems to be, and this is facial, and you can look this up online just by looking at the different policies that are out there. There's discrimination against what I'll call non-hierarchical or discriminate religions or non-organized religions. How does this work? Some schools and Hofstra, my own institution is one of them, for a student to get an exemption, the student must attach a letter from a religious leader of their organization. Well, that assumes a hierarchy. That assumes the existence of a religious leader. Not every religion operates that way. So what if you belong to a faith, a religion that doesn't have a sort of a leadership structure, a hierarchy? You cannot provide that letter. The cases have been consistent, again, outside of the specific area of New York, because there are no cases, but the cases across the country have been specific that if you preference organized religion over religion that's not organized, that's a form of religious discrimination, as it must be. And then finally, this is the trickiest one, what I call, for lack of a better term, contingent religious obligations. Colleges seem to have trouble with that. So it's easy to say and easy to adjudicate a situation where a student says, my religion teaches I shall not consume pork. And so if a vaccine is made with pork gelatin, I can't touch it. But there are other religions, and again, Catholicism is the one that I know the most about here, that has conscience-based objections, where the church has sort of definitive teachings, but then the application of those teachings is left up to the individual adherent to decide for himself or herself what their religious obligations are. Colleges seem to be struggling with that, and they seem to think that unless there's a categorical denial, right, thou shalt not take a vaccine or thou shalt not take any vaccine, unless your religion preaches that, you can't apply for the exemption. But again, what matters is this your religion? Yes. Does your religion teach that you have under pain of sin, an obligation to follow your conscience? If the answer to that is yes, and you put forth that in your application, and they deny it, they discriminate against you because your religion perhaps is too complicated for them to understand, or it's not one they want to grant the exemption to. So with that, and that's a lot to chew on, and I am from New York, so I talk a little bit fast. So let me pause now and turn things over to Stephanie, who I imagine has a few questions in the audience that might have a few others. So again, thank you for that time.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that overview. And you know, this article raises a couple of points that really aren't discussed too often in debates over the legality of vaccine mandates and religious exemptions. The two main points that you already touched on, but first was that these debates usually talk about federal constitutional rights and that they often ignore what rights are available at the state level. And for students and professors at private universities, particularly private non-sectarian universities, they aren't really given much attention as to what possible venues they might have and what possible rights they might have. So that your article was really interesting for that perspective. And then a lot of it, as you mentioned, maybe these areas are relatively unexplored in state law. So arguing by analogy to federal constitutional law is a very, very persuasive way to handle that. And then next, the article talks about the fact that not all religious exemptions are created equal. So a lot of times these discussions talk about whether they have a religious exemption or not, and that's kind of the end of the discussion, whether you're required to have one. But they don't get into the nitty-gritty of how they have to be, how they have to be applied, and what considerations schools should take into account when applying them, and some pitfalls that they need to avoid. So the argument in that section of your article would be applicable to either public or private school contexts, because it's mostly arguing from analogy to the federal constitutional law. So that was a very helpful explanation of the four main pitfalls that could befall a school, and maybe they don't even realize that they're doing that.
So can I respond to a couple of those things? And thank you. I mean, you spot on. I think it's exactly what I'm trying to say. I want to say two things. Let me write them down so I don't forget. Why? Let's go in reverse order. Why are schools doing this? In other words, you know, why are they? I think a lot of schools, quite frankly, are trying to get away with something and hoping they're not going to get called on. The law is not clear here. And this will lead to point two I want to make. So, for example, when I was on a homeowners association trustees board, we implemented all sorts of regulations about yard signs and political signs that, frankly, if challenged, we lose. We just lose. But most people don't challenge, right? Most people obey. And if they don't obey, you threaten them with a fine, and then they'll obey. Or if they really resist, maybe you drop the fine, and then they'll obey. The point is, a lot of times people push the envelope. And when the law is not settled or not very clear, I think it empowers universities to say, okay, I think we can get away with this. Maybe they know in heart of hearts if challenged, they wouldn't win, but who's going to challenge them? They just don't expect it to happen. So I think you have a lot of envelope pushing going on here. Number two, though, you mentioned faculty. You mentioned like students and professors. Without mentioning names, I've gotten my hands on at one institution, the same institution, their form for a faculty and employee exemption and the form for a student exemption. Right? The form for the student exemption did everything wrong. It required a letter from one's religious leader and all that stuff. The same institution, their form for an employee exemption didn't have that. It was much better. Now, why would that be? Because there's a lot of federal law in the books. The EEOC actually says you cannot discriminate against employees on the basis of religion. There's a rich jurisprudence in that area, and they realize they can't do certain things. But when it comes to students, they think they're in the Wild West. They can do whatever they want. They're probably thinking, we don't have to give them an exemption. So whatever we give them, we could just make up, you know. But if you're in a state like New York, okay, yeah, you can make it up so long as it's not discriminatory. And some of these made-up exemptions, as I've argued, are crossing the line into discrimination.
So that's our first question from a listener was exactly that question. They asked, would it be discrimination if a private school allows religious exemptions for faculty and staff, but not for students? So is that, what are the angles at play there?
Okay, great question. they have to, under federal law, EEOC law, they have to provide religious exemptions to faculty and to employees must receive a religious exemption to a vaccine mandate under federal law. Okay, so that's a given. Now, as to your specific question, if they give an exemption to faculty and staff, but not to students, are they violating the law? Or is that you're saying? No, they don't, because students don't have federal rights with regard to religion. Excuse me. In fact, a lot of schools, in Hofstra was one of them until yesterday, quite frankly, only required the mandate of students. In other words, a lot of schools, and this is just perverse on so many levels if you think about it, but let me go down this road for a moment. A lot of schools have said, we mandate our students to receive the vaccine, but not our own employees and professors. Now, that's a classic externality, and it's a perverse one too, right? Because you're mandating the vaccination of the people that are least likely to really need it to protect those who probably should get it themselves, right? Or most likely to need it. Let's put it that way. So, but in any event, they've gotten away with that. No one has said that this is a discrimination against students because you're making students get the, making them have the vaccine, but not their professors. No one's argued that successfully, and I don't see the basis for that.
Yeah, so I guess maybe this would be a good time to kind of back up and just talk about the legality of vaccine mandates to begin with and some of the current challenges that are out there. There's the Indiana University lawsuit right now where students are arguing that their school's vaccine mandate violates their 14th Amendment rights to bodily integrity, bodily autonomy, and medical treatment choice. And so can you tell me a little bit about that? Arguments and the court so far has not accepted it. It went up to the Seventh Circuit and it was not accepted. So,
yeah, well, this is, and again, Stephanie, I invite you to flesh this one out because I think here Stephanie knows more than I do and is certainly the far better expert. But as far as I've been able to tell thus far, the lawsuits claiming that these mandates are unlawful because it's emergency use only. And there was a great New York Law Journal article on this that I think really spelled out compellingly the argument for why an emergency use authorized vaccine cannot be mandated. Those arguments just haven't been winning. As far as I can tell, they're 0-2, 0-3, 0-4. They're not winning. The bodily integrity arguments don't seem to be winning. I have yet to see a case in which a religious exemption denial has been litigated. Those cases are not out yet. And I'm hoping that, part of this is proselytization. I'm hoping that there are parents listening or people that know parents, that know people in school that might say, wow, you know, maybe we do have a leg to stand on here. In fact, I think, and Stephanie, if you know, feel free to correct me. I think in the Indiana suit, one of the reasons the students lost, one of the reasons I think that was cited to, I think, is the judges said something like, but there's an exemption if you have a religious objection. So that's one of the reasons you lose. Now that was a public institution though. So that's not private. So that wasn't the focus of my article, but it does suggest that in order to win these lawsuits with these mandates, an exemption might be required, right? Especially for a public institution.
Yeah. So in the Seventh Circuit, they said that it was one of the reasons was because most of the students qualified for religious exemption. And then subsequently, the Indiana University also allowed an ethical exception. So presumably that could boot the entire case now that there are exemptions. But then also the other main argument that the court relied on was that essentially this isn't an unconstitutional condition because you can go elsewhere to receive your education. So that was, so that's for that reason. And they found that there was no fundamental right to not receive a vaccine here. So that was one court case. There are others being challenged. There's the George Mason case that a professor brought a lawsuit against George Mason based on his natural immunity and arguing that that one violated his 14th Amendment rights as well. So that was recently filed. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that one.
That's Todd Zwicky, who actually I know. That's an interesting argument too. I wish him the best of luck. And that's another thing that's interesting. People talk about following the science. A lot of people who have antibodies, even at Hofstra, that there's not an exemption. You've already caught COVID, so you don't feel like you have a need for the vaccine. In fact, some of the studies suggest that the antibodies may even be more effective. And this isn't conspiratorial stuff. This is just science. Antibodies may be even more effective than the vaccine, yet they're still imposing the vaccine on people who have antibodies. So he's one of these people, Todd Zubicki, Professor George Mason, contracted COVID, recovered, and now they're forcing him to take a vaccine. And his point is, I have natural immunity. It's not a religious exemption argument, but it's a bodily integrity and sort of just patently unreasonableness, you know, and it's a public institution. So there are different rules. Another takeaway, and this is a statement against interest because I do work at a private institution. I really would think twice about sending my kid in the future to a school that's not public. Not only do you spend a lot more money, typically speaking, at a private university, but you just don't have the same rights you would at a public institution.
Yeah, another angle that your article touches on is potential contract theory arguments. So it's possible that students and especially professors might have some sort of an argument based on breach of contract. If you're a returning student or if you're a tenured professor, for example, something that was interesting. I don't know if we need to go into that, but that's an interesting angle.
So thank you. So I definitely flagged this. I mean, there are so many different things you can go into. And that's something that also I think is completely unexplored. And if I could inspire someone on this call to take up that mantle, in other words, think about this. As we all know from law school, you can't modify a contract without consideration. You can't in the middle of a contract say, I'm going to change the conditions now, and you still have to pay me what you agreed to pay me, et cetera, et cetera. You can't do that. Now, how do colleges get away with doing that? Well, they have in their student policies language that says we're allowed to amend our policies at any way, you know, throughout, you know, at any time, and you're subject to them. So the courts have upheld that type of stuff. Like if I have a contract, you know, with Stephanie, and the contract states I can amend this contract unilaterally, that is generally enforceable. However, you know, facts matter. Is there a point at which the amendment is so material that it is no longer enforceable? It is a breach. Mandating the emergency use only authorized vaccine in the middle or the last year of someone's college education as a condition for them to maintain that education and continue their degree. I'd love to see that challenged as a contracts professor. I think that really pushes the limits of, you know, is that unconscionable? Are you really allowed to do that? Does that clause give you that much power? I don't go into this in my note. My argument is my article is all about, again, religious exemptions, but that's an area that someone really ought to look into.
Yeah. And then, all right. So we talked about whether you're prima facie allowed to have this sort of vaccine mandate, and that's currently being decided by the courts, and then whether universities are required to offer that. So the answer is, it depends. There are a few situations that I think your article flags some of these, but when a public school might not be allowed to or might be required to offer religious exemption, if there was any sort of evidence that you're discriminatorily targeting a religion in how you're employing this vaccine mandate rollout. If you're granting a non-religious exemption, you have to also grant a religious exemption unless you can meet the strict scrutiny. At least there's an argument under Roman Catholic Diocese and Tandon.
Oh, I would totally agree with that with regard to public institutions, right? With a public institution, right? That's RFRA or that's the state RFRA. Or but if it's a private institution, I'm not sure if that's the case. But I agree with you completely. If it's a public institution, once you have that medical exemption, I think you now are required to have the religious exemption.
Yeah, and then so that brings us to the next comment from one of the listeners is talking about the rights of students at religious schools. So a lot of times, so they're talking about Christian student enrolled in a yeshiva or a Muslim student enrolled at a Catholic school. Are there any considerations there? I guess you want to address that?
I can. So the New York Human Rights Law, which is what I focused on. And again, I imagine, I just repeat this, your state probably has one as well. And you look into it and see what it covers. New York Human Rights Law specifically carves out religious schools, right? So if you're a Catholic school, a Lutheran school, a yeshiva, you can discriminate on the basis of religion for reasons that might be obvious. And then my note doesn't go down that road. So I haven't explored the contours of that. So this article focuses on the schools that are non-sectarian.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. So schools that are religious generally have a right to create a community that is consistent with their own religious beliefs. So that's what makes a Catholic school a Catholic school, is that they can abide by their own Catholic beliefs, for example, and the same with the yeshiva and a Muslim school of any faith. And so really what you're considering here is, let's see, I had another another thought here. So yeah, you'd have to look at the particular state laws that are involved. If you have religious freedom laws that go beyond Smith, when we're talking about the rights of students at private universities in general. And so now let's go to the heart of your article, which is those nitty-gritty ways in which if your school has decided to give a religious exemption, you have to make sure that you do so in a non-discriminatory way. And some schools might be well-meaning, we'll give them the benefit of the doubt here, but they just don't know how to do it, or they're not sure, or they're concerned about insincerity. That would be an issue that would come up.
Well, this is a very real challenge that I try to acknowledge in the piece. There is a debate raging as to whether or not higher education is itself biased against students of faith, generally speaking, right? We could probably spend an hour on that subject, and there's evidence to believe that it is. But let's, for argument's sake, put that aside. Let's imagine these are well-meaning university administrators. They have no bias against particular students or particular religions. They're just trying to do their job. They have a policy of vaccination, which, what does that mean? That means they want everyone to be vaccinated. They want to promulgate a religious exemption because they don't want to, almost virtually everyone that does have a mandate has a religious exemption. The numbers are in the 90 percentile, 95, 96, 97. Very few. I'm not aware of any universities that have they might be out there, but they're extremely rare, that have a mandate without a religious exemption. Religious exemptions are sort of commonplace. So you don't want to be on the wrong side of that line. You look really awful, right? Especially in today's, I mentioned this in the article too. I mean, today it's all about diversity and inclusion. Are you really going to carve out religious students for sort of second class treatment when everybody else treats them differently, treats them, with compassion? So no. So in other words, if you have an administrator, they're trying to exercise their discretion here in whether or not to grant an exemption or not. They want to grant as few as possible, because otherwise why have the vaccination mandate to begin with, right? So the policy is to vaccinate the students, but they want to still have this exemption. So I think that creates tremendous pressure to exercise their discretion in a way that's really parsimonious and really strict. And so I don't think it's because there's animus per se against Catholics or Lutherans or Jews or Muslims, what have you. I don't think that's it. I think it's simply they're trying to test for sincerity and they're being overly broad. So when a Catholic student says, I have an objection to this vaccine, they want an excuse to shoot them down. And we say, well, the Pope says it's okay to take the vaccine, so you lose. Now that same faculty might have on staff a professor who teaches all sorts of things as Catholic that are against Catholic teaching. Like, so this, if the university opened the hood of its own car, it would see and learn that not every person who belongs to a particular denomination necessarily believes exactly what that denomination believes. They might believe some things that are idiosyncratic. That makes it no less sincere. But again, I do feel for the schools that are trying to get that sincerity check. My argument is they have to find other ways of doing it, whether it's letters of reference. I'm not talking from a religious leader, because as we discussed, that's problematic. But perhaps from, three or four friends. Like if someone applies for a permit to get a firearm, right? You need to have some references, have to sign off that you're not unstable or problematic. Perhaps you could have, references. People sign letters saying, I know so-and-so for so long, and I'm aware that these are that person's true beliefs, yada, 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 whatever. The point is, though, you cannot use a discriminatory means. The ends don't justify the means, right? So the end is we want to make sure the student's sincere. They can't further that end by using means that serve to discriminate against students on the basis of religion, which is what's going on, I fear, and I know.
Yeah, yes, it raises a lot of very interesting points. So a school might push back and argue that they're asking for information about beliefs because they're trying to evaluate sincerity. And of course, there's no right to accommodate the religious belief that someone has if they don't actually hold that belief. But on the other hand, we haven't seen a lot of court cases that are evaluating sincerity outside of the prison context. In the prison RLUIPA context, you might have a prisoner who says that they're entitled to steak meals every dinner, or they want kosher food because they think it's better. And so then if you find them having a ham sandwich the day after they request their religious exemption, then that can be evidence against their sincerity. So those are usually the contexts that you see sincerity being an issue in First Amendment type litigation. But often in other contexts, it's usually taken for granted that they are sincere, and there isn't a lot of kind of skepticism that we're seeing right now, and kind of this kind of a presumption that you might not be telling the truth that some of these colleges might have. So it's kind of an interesting novel area that needs to be explored a little more.
Oh, Stephanie, you're totally right. I mean, this is absolutely against the grain, right? So under constitutional jurisprudence, because of separation church and state, the government is strictly forbidden from serving as an inquisitor. So long as the person's beliefs appear to be sincere, the government has to take it at face value and move on. The EEOC guidance with regard to employment discrimination on the basis of religion states that unless there's a reason to doubt the applicant, the employee's sincerity, you kind of have to accept it at face value. Here we seem to flip that around. A lot of schools seem to be saying, prove your sincerity or else. And I like the EEOC's approach. The EEOC basically said, unless there's a reason to doubt the sincerity, you don't. I mean, this is sort of C.S. Lewis's approach, I think, in Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. When the students come to him and say, you know, so-and-so said there's a magic forest behind the wardrobe, you know, tell him stop lying. And the professor in the house says, well, has he lied before? No. So why do you think he's lying now? It's just a cute little anecdote and some logical reasoning going on that our society is largely bereft of. But the point is, you assume the person's telling the truth unless you have credible reasons to believe otherwise.
Yeah, and it goes back to a long line of cases where the Supreme Court has said even if they are maybe having trouble articulating, or if they have different beliefs than other people in the same and the same religion or the same denomination, like the Thomas V. Review Board case, that's no reason to question the sincerity, because not every Jehovah's Witness, not every Catholic thinks the same, and they might hold different religious beliefs with regard to different issues. And so maybe a lot of administrators don't realize that there isn't a one size fits all. It's all here. So maybe you can give some examples of maybe good school policies and maybe some very problematic ones.
Well, I do have to say that I think you also put your finger on something, and it's going to be a problem in the future more than even today, is the illiteracy when it comes to sort of matters of religion. Newspapers, for example, and media sources do an awful job reporting on religion. This has been well sort of documented. I think similarly, school administrators who might be of a secular bent just don't really understand and appreciate religion and its nuances, right? And this is why I added that fourth category that when I called about contingent obligations. I mean, heaven forbid you have a student whose religion teaches that it's up to the student to decide whether or not something violates their religion. And that blows up the heads of these administrators. I don't think they can handle that. They don't understand the discretionary element seems to make it a choice to them, but it's not, right? If you conclude that something's a sin, you no longer have a choice. Right. In any event, so what's a good policy? I use Syracuse University as a decent policy. It says religious exemption is allowed if the student submits a written, signed, and dated statement that an immunization conflicts with sincerely held religious beliefs. Now some schools require you to flesh out the nature of the beliefs. The principles, you have to explain it, and you have to then tie it to the vaccination. Some schools then go so far as to suggest you have to be opposed to all immunization in order to get a vaccination exemption, which is, again, problematic. And going back to the Muslim example of pork, you cannot inject something with pork into your body if you believe that as a Muslim. But to send a vaccine doesn't have any implication with that. No pork gelatin, right? You could. So you'd certainly have a sincere religious belief with regard to a pork-based vaccination, but not to one that's non-pork. And this is the same thing with the abortion link, right? A lot of the Christian objections to the... there are sort of two mainstream Christian objections to the COVID vaccinations that I'm aware of. One is this sort of general bodily integrity, I'm against medicine type vaccination. That's like the Christian Scientist approach. But then the other one is the abortion link, right? Every single COVID vaccination has been tested upon or derived from cells taken from an aborted human baby. That's a real problem for a lot of Christian believers. And but it's not a problem, let's say, with the tetanus shot, right? And so to say to a Christian student, we're only going to give you the exemption if you're post all vaccinations. I think some schools like to take this approach because it's nice and easy. And then you can show vaccination records. But you got vaccines before, you know, no suit for you. You lose, you're out. I don't think that's fair, right? Because I don't think you would do that to a Muslim student and say, well, I can't take this because there's pork in it. Why should you force a Christian student to take a vaccine that's related to linked to abortion just because they took one that wasn't linked to abortion? So anyway, so you say, what's a good policy? Look, I mean, and again, Stephanie, I'd love your thoughts on this, whether now or another time. Religious liberty in a pluralistic society is messy and difficult. It just is. I mean, that's my conclusion. And this is why I think Justice Scalia and Smith was so down on it, quite frankly. But Congress reacted, I think, appropriately and overturned that with RFRA. I guess what I'm saying is if you're going to apply religious exemption, yeah, you're going to have a lot of students with idiosyncratic religious beliefs. You're going to have difficulty assessing the sincerity of those beliefs. But you can't cross the line into discriminatory means of implementing that requirement. You know, it's tough.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you probably get a lot of agreement that if a school is granting a religious exemption, they have to make sure they do it in a non-discriminatory way. And they have to be very careful that they're not accidentally just preferencing one religion over another in how they're going about this. If they're making distinctions, they have to be well-founded in narrowly tailored between the religions, the different religions. So it looks like we've got quite a few questions that are piling in. Evelyn, do you have are any of these particularly, are there any that we should address first that you see? Otherwise, I will just start going through some of the questions.
Please go ahead and dive through. There are a lot of questions.
Okay, that's great. Questions are great. We'll get as many as we can. Let me just then very briefly, though, respond to something else you just said there, Stephanie. If you do promulgate, at least in New York, a student is seen to be in a contractual relationship with the university. So going back to the contract argument, if you're and in New York and every state that I know of, every contract has a good faith element imbued within it. So if a school does implement announce a religious exemption, I would say that they're legally bound to implement it in a good faith, rational way, right? So to the extent that they announce one, but then they really don't give it to anybody, that I would say is a contract violation. So imagine a school that announces a religious exemption and then grants it to no one. I don't think that's religious discrimination, but I think that's a contract issue, right? Because you're not announcing this in good faith. I just want to throw that out there as a potential other area of exploration.
Yeah. All right. So I guess we'll just start taking the questions. So one of the questions is asking how Jacobson plays into all of this. Do we have to take into consideration the fact that in Jacobson, it was a 1905 case in Massachusetts where they required everyone to get the smallpox vaccine or pay a $5 fine, which is about $140 today in today's dollars. So does the fact that it had looking at the penalty, does that come to account when you're talking about unconstitutional conditions at universities? So the penalty there would be losing your tenure or losing your being forced to attend a different university.
That's kind of Todd Zewicki's argument in the George Mason University lawsuit. He's saying that I think they have a plan B. If you don't get vaccinated, there is some other sort of route you could take. And his point was that route would be detrimental to his career. So, what happens when a university promulgates a mandate that gives you the option of either get the exemption or, this is common, I'm sorry, take the vaccine or subject yourself to daily testing, yeah. Right? at public, I think that is tenable. I think you could certainly do that. Then your question becomes, at what point does the plan B become so onerous? It's really not a choice, right? So a $5 fine, $100 fine is probably not a big deal. But if it's either get the exemption or go part-time, I mean, either take the vaccine or go part-time, that would be an issue. I hate to say it, but that's beyond the scope of what I've written about. I'd say that's a good point though, right? I think the more enlightened schools, the more enlightened policies have though given people reasonable choices following the science. They've said stuff like, either get the vaccine or subject yourself to weekly testing. Now, nobody likes weekly testing, but if you tested weekly, you're safe. Or better yet, get the vaccine or take your classes online. We all know we can teach online now. We've been doing it for a year. So I think you asked me earlier, Stephanie, about approaches. I think those are great, better approaches. Because then it's really not about exemptions per se. It's about giving people actual choice.
Yeah, that's a great point. So the next question is asking if schools must schools allow a claim of exemption based on conscience objections to vaccines that could be based in religion, say for existence, or for example, stem cells that you were mentioning earlier, but with which the student doesn't explicitly assert on that basis. So that's an interesting question. Do you have to raise it as a religious exemption?
So again, Stephanie can answer this as well as I can, but she's being a very polite moderator and letting me answer these questions. But the Supreme Court has been clear that conscience does not equal religion. The more enlightened schools, I think, would include a conscience objection, right? They'd say religion or conscience, because the line between the two is close. And again, especially for Catholics, where you have a religious obligation to follow your conscience if it's properly formed, where is that line? But to answer your question, you do not, unless your state has some idiosyncratic law that I'm unaware of, at least in New York, you can promulgate a religious exemption and exclude a conscience exemption. In fact, Hofstra's policy specifically states that, philosophical objections don't count. They have to be truly religious. They don't define what religious means, though. But again, I hope I'm not being circuitous. You can promulgate an exemption that's strictly religious and carves out conscience and say conscience objections don't count. I don't think that's good, but under law, you're on firm ground for doing that, for excluding conscience-based objections.
Yeah, it's interesting if you look at the in the K through 12 situation. Every state require certain childhood vaccines to attend K through 12 schools. And so they might differ as to which exactly vaccines they require, but 44 of the states allow religious exemptions and 15 allow other sorts of conscience or ethical exceptions. It's definitely an increasing trend to allow other kinds of exemptions, but it's not universal across the state in that context. Obviously, if we're talking about COVID in a COVID vaccine in a university context, it's a different consideration, different laws would apply. But that's just interesting to throw that out there. All right, let's look at some of the other questions that we have. Let's see. So someone's talking about personal bodily integrity with respect to unreasonable searches. This issue was raised in the Loyola Marymount case. I don't know if you have had a chance to see that one. That one also raises state actor issues. So we have private students at a religious school, Loyola Marymount, that... it's definitely a private school because maybe there might be some questions whether it's religion. I'm not sure. And so the court denied a preliminary injunction because it wasn't acting as a state actor. It's a private university and they were raising constitutional claims. So one of those constitutional claims was personal bodily integrity against unreasonable searches, which I hadn't heard before in this context. So that was kind of an interesting angle. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. This is very far outside the scope of...
No. Isn't that what Indiana is raising? The students there are raising that a little bit too? Or is that... And maybe Todd Zawicki and George Mason is sort of... those are the arguments that you could use against a public university, I think, because they're constitutional based.
Yeah. So that's definitely a problem in the Loyola one, is that it's against a a private university. That's the first threshold problem. They were raising it in a Fourth Amendment context. So in the Indiana University case and the George Mason, those are primarily 14th Amendment arguments based on substantive due process rights. All right, I guess we'll move on to, let's see, another question that's kind of outside the scope was, are schools willing to bear the liability or short term?
Yeah, so, you know, again, it's outside the scope. I've seen a lot of people suggest that if a school says you must take the vaccine, you ask them to sign a waiver that says if I'm infertile in 20 years, you know, you have to pay for that infertility. Am I going to be banned from Twitter for even mentioning that as a possibility? I don't know. Anyway, the point, I'm not crediting that argument. My point is there have been people on the internet saying that you could try to force your employer or your school to sign a waiver, the exact opposite, right? A statement of responsibility for consequences. I'm unaware of anyone successfully procuring a signature on that document. It sounds great. It looks great. I think it's good as sort of part of a general nasty letter strategy, but why would they sign it? They'll just say no. And so I'd love to get someone to sign it, and I would certainly ask them to sign it, but I don't see why they wouldn't. I don't see why they would have to.
Yeah, we've seen it the other way around. In some of the requests for medical exemptions and religious exemptions, you have to sign a waiver saying yes, that you are aware of the risks of denying them, of not receiving the vaccine, and that you're not going to hold people accountable for that. The question is in the ballpark of what's going on right now.
Yes, it is.
It's just not from that angle.
No, and it goes to those contract issues, right? It's all one-sided. It's one way.
Would a force majeure play in part of the contract?
As I mentioned, I'd love to unpack that one day, and I haven't gone into it, but perhaps yes. I mean, it seems like it could. No one's raised those arguments yet. And I'm surprised that this hasn't been. That's another surprising thing, Stephanie. I mentioned there's a dearth of New York case law on this narrow question of religious liberty exemptions, religious exemptions. But just in general, these vaccination mandates at schools, there are so many other grounds upon which they've been challenged. I just haven't seen them come up. I'm just surprised that the case, because I've read the cases closely, as I imagine you have. They've all been like, a lot of have been emergency use authorization and 14th Amendment type issues, but there are some real contract issues that could come up that no one seems to be articulating yet.
Yeah, I wonder if some of the reason why they haven't come up in the New York human rights law is New York isn't exactly known as a hotbed of religious freedom respect these days. So perhaps that's that it would explain some of the dearth of case law in that area. But there certainly are states that have similar laws that could and should be explored more.
Yeah. And, you know, if you get yourself before a federal judge because you're an out-of-state student, in a diversity jurisdiction, if you could pull that off, then you get a federal judge looking at the New York state law, and the federal judiciary, I think, has been definitely solicitous toward religion and religious rights and whatnot. I mean, broadly speaking. So I think there's room for success there.
Yeah. So as we are getting close to the hour, I think now might be a good time to just say, if we had to step back a second and see if you have any closing thoughts or any other points that we should really address before we wrap up.
I mean, I just wish someone would have the gumption to take one of these schools on, because you know how this stuff works, right? Once somebody loses somewhere, the alarm bells go off and a lot of people then get into line. And in fact, unfortunately, that right now, litigation has been completely opposite direction, right? The claims have all been defeated time and again, but this particular claim has never come up yet, has never been raised. And I'm just looking at the policies on their face, especially the requirement of a letter from a religious leader. There are a lot of college students in New York that don't want this vaccination and they're all lining up to get it. I think they just force majeure, they feel pressured, they're halfway through school, they can't transfer. It's really an awful situation the students find themselves in. It might be smart I would just love to see some of the stuff litigated, because I think some of the cases would break in the favor of students. But until we have those cases, I think universities are going to remain emboldened to push the envelope this way.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. The time is right for cases that are challenging how these religious exemptions are applied, not just the mere existence of these religious exemptions, and make sure that students are actually respected in the process.
Yes.
And not treated with hostility, not treated with as second-class citizens on the basis of their religious beliefs. And so this is a really important issue. I'm sorry that we can't get to all of the good questions that we have today. A lot of them are asking questions that are a little outside scope of the article and religious freedom exemptions. I think they raise really interesting points that would be good for another discussion.
Perhaps. Thank you so very much. It's been an absolute pleasure working with you today on this, Stephanie, and the days before today, and to the Federalist Society once again, and to the great questions. I thank the audience.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. We're so glad to have this discussion, be able to pick your brain and talk about this really interesting article and really interesting topic.
You're most welcome.
Thanks very much. I'll just add to that the thanks of the Federalist Society. That was just a fascinating conversation. If any of our audience members have comments, please send those comments into info@fed-soc.org. Thank you all for joining today. Thank you to our audience for your good questions. Thank you to our speakers for their expertise and their time today. And with all that being said, we are adjourned. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.